SiriusXM presents Stanford Pathfinders.
Stanford has 225,000 alumni living all over the globe in 151 countries, and they're some of the most amazing people you would ever want to meet.
A show about how the graduates of Stanford University are changing our lives and the world.
We'll hear very interesting things from business leaders in the technology sector, but well beyond that, the worlds of politics, entertainment, business, and beyond.
Inspiring stories from America's innovation heartland.
It's a place where people look to the future, not to the past, where they don't rest on their laurels. Think about the gold rush. Think about Stanford being formed in the late 1800s. And then Stanford was the beginning of Silicon Valley. And the ethos of Silicon Valley is deeply embedded in the Stanford spirit. It's a spirit of innovation, experimentation. It's a spirit of being willing to try new things and risk failure as long as you fail forward.
Welcome to Stanford Pathfinders.
This week on Stanford Pathfinders, an alumna who faced the hardships of growing up in a racially homogenous community head on.
The fact that I was a different race did not compute. I was that different. I was that unusual in that framework that they didn't know what I was.
Now she's telling the world what it means to be a real American.
We all want to matter here. We all want to make our way. We all want to find work and find love and not be judged or shot down because we have the wrong skin color.
Today on Stanford Pathfinders, best-selling author Julie Lithcott-Hames. Here's your host, Howard Wolf.
Since its founding in 1891, Stanford University has embraced diversity in all its forms. Stanford was co-educational from its inception and welcomed students from all faith traditions, international students, and students of color in its first classes. This commitment to diversity has never waned and continues as a strong imperative to this day. Notwithstanding this commitment, discussions about race continue to be strained and difficult at Stanford and at most other U.S. colleges and universities. And if such conversations are difficult on college campuses, where the winds of freedom tend to blow more freely than elsewhere, it is hard to see such discourse flowing easily elsewhere across the land. Our guest on today's episode of Stanford Pathfinders is Julie Lithcott-Hames. Julie is the classic overachiever. She holds a BA in American Studies from Stanford University, a JD from Harvard Law School, and an MFA in Writing from California College of the Arts. She is a reformed attorney, a reformed higher ed student affairs professional, and a current author and personality. Her latest book, Real American, is a fearless memoir in which Julie tells the real story of growing up a Black woman in America. Julie, welcome to the show.
Howard, thank you for having me.
So I have in my hands here your new book entitled Real American, and it's a memoir. But you're pretty young for a memoir, so help me understand, why'd you write this book? What is this book about?
Who are you to write a memoir, my friend? You're not old enough. That's basically what you're asking.
Exactly.
Yes, I am just 50 and never really feel young at that age, except when people like you ask me questions like that. I got to a point in my early 40s when I began to reckon with issues of race that had plagued me for much of my life. Plagued me, but hunkered down and hid inside of me, away from my consciousness. And in my early 40s, I began, for reasons of what was happening in my own life, going back to grad school, writing poetry, but also for reasons of what was happening on a national level. Trayvon Martin's murdered. His murderer goes free. I began to reckon with issues of race in my own life. I began to summon them to my own consciousness, summon them out of the places in which they were hiding to kind of, you know, the front part of my brain. And these became truths that were too painful not to talk about.
So let's back up here for a second so that we can give the listeners sort of some context.
Yeah.
The book, Real American, chronicles what it was like for you to grow up as a biracial Black woman in America.
Yeah.
Right? And you talk in the book about being the other. So how do you define yourself racially? What's your background?
Yeah.
And help us understand this.
Yeah. So I have identified as Black, biracial, and Black again. And here's why. Coming up in the early 1970s, my Black father and white mother were told, as were all parents who were interracially married, if you have children, raise them to be Black because America will see them as Black. Therefore, they'd better be Black and proud. And that wisdom, frankly, holds to this day. Now, my parents' mistake was raising me in all white towns. So they said, you're black. But it was really on me to decode that. My black parent, my father, traveled extensively for work. He was a physician. He was in academia. He was in international work. And so my black parent was rather absent, very busy and successful. But it was up to my white mother to help me figure out what it meant to be a black child and raising me in white towns.
And she tried really—
made it a mystery. She did.
Really hard.
Okay, so we had to hold on that. Let me try to answer this question, then we need to get to my mother and how she tried hard. She tried hard. She's the blackest white lady I knew, I call her. So they told me I was black, but what I'm trying to say is it didn't have any cultural richness to that. The definition was lacking in depth. I was trying to figure out what it meant to be black from the media, trying not to be the black people they put on the news and said were bad, and trying to be more like the black people I saw in sitcoms, literally. I was watching The Cosby Show for evidence of how to be someone like me. When biracial was offered as a term in our American lexicon in the late 80s, I grabbed it. I sort of tried to bring it into my being like an organ transplant. Like, aha, this finally makes sense. I don't have to ignore my white mother anymore. You know, I am biracial. Then I came to appreciate as I grew, did a lot of work with a coach, you know, that actually I'm afraid of claiming the title black because I loathe being black. I've been given the message that black is problematic and unworthy and not smart and criminal. And so I have actually loathed myself as a black person, which is why I couldn't really claim the label. Once I acknowledged that, then I liberated myself from it. Basically, racism had made me loathe my black self. I stared that in the eye and said, hell no, that's effed up. I don't know what I'm allowed to say on this show. And I was able to reclaim black and call myself black. So that has been the arc of my identity journey.
That's been the journey. So let's get back to your mom.
Yeah.
Not only a white mother, a British white mother is trying to raise you to embrace your blackness.
Yeah.
And the
God
book is just so beautiful as you describe this.
Yeah.
I mean, she was going into territory that was not known well to
her. Unchartered by anybody. This was new. Being a mixed kid in the early 1970s, there were hardly any of us, which is a contrast to the state of things
today. And living in the very, very black state of
Wisconsin. Yeah, where I heard things like, this was high school. Well, I was actually there twice, third and fourth grade, and then ninth through 12th. And the intervening years, fifth through eighth, were when we were in the D.C. area because my dad was part of the Carter administration. So now we're back in Wisconsin. I become the student body president of my all-white high school, 1,200 kids, two Jewish families, and us. And I hear things like from the very benign, oh my gosh, you're so tan. Oh my God, like, you're so tan. No, 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 lady. Well, yes, I am darker than I would be in January because it's August and we're here at a pool, but I am actually African-American. The fact that I was a different race did not compute. I was that different. I was that unusual in that framework that they didn't know what I was.
You were that other.
And then I was really black. I was that other. And then I was so black, they wrote the N-word on my locker on my 17th birthday when I am president of the student council. I am cut at the knees by the writing of the N-word on my locker. And I didn't tell anybody because I was so ashamed to be black.
But you not only didn't tell anybody then.
I didn't tell anybody for decades.
For decades.
Decades until I began writing poetry in my 40s. And that shit started to come up and out of me. Yeah, I hid from those things. I tried to be the black person that would never be called the N-word again by performing my way into white spaces to receive the applause and the approval and so on and so forth of white American society, trying to be the black person, it's called respectability politics. You know, be that black person they'll be friendly and kind to, maybe offer a job to, maybe promote up through their ranks.
And then you get into Stanford.
Mm.
And people question that.
Yeah. My friend, who was not the student body president, had also applied to Stanford and not gotten in. His dad makes it about our SAT scores, which apparently he'd heard about. I don't remember the scores at this point, but his boy's scores were higher than mine. And the dad said to me, you know, do you think it's fair that you got into Stanford over my son when he had scores that were higher than that? I mean, I was a freaking student council president, you know, that should count for something. But apparently, no, I had stolen his son's spot at Stanford by being black or by having lower test scores and being black.
So you go to Stanford undergraduate.
Kind of believing what this guy has intimated.
And then you go to Harvard Law School. Then you go to work at one of the premier law firms in the country. You transition to one of the most powerful technology companies in the world.
Bum, 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 bum.
And then you end up as a senior administrator at Stanford University.
Yes.
But at the same time, amidst all of this, you've convinced yourself that you're anything but a success, that you're almost self-loathing. And I look at your arc of your career and your performance and your education, and I just shake my head and say, what's that all about?
I was a success by outward measures, without a doubt. And I had risen to the ranks of the upper middle class, and I'd, you know, well-degreed, well-heeled, that sort of thing. But what I'm trying to say is all of that was based on an anguished need to perform a certain way to make it in white society. When I discovered that my own self-loathing was at the base of this, like I'm trying not to be that black person, you know, I'm trying to be black but smart, black but accomplished. When I finally came to terms with that and realized that that success is sitting within this chasm of self-loathing, I was able to call it what it was and began to heal from that self-loathing. So I wish I had been able to do those things out of an interest in my own growth, in my own seeking of opportunities to make some kind of difference in the world.
You were performing.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So in your memoir, you talk about something called belonging.
Yeah.
And belonging is a huge, huge topic of discussion today in America. And it's difficult for people to find the place where they belong. But you come at it from a different vector. So belonging is a big theme. Talk to us about what that means to you. What does it mean to belong?
To belong is to know who you are and to belong to the self, first of all. And then to be in community with people who love you and accept you for who you are. We all crave that across gender, ethnicity, class, all other aspects of background. We're all hungry for that sense of belonging. I'm not an anthropologist, but if we had an anthropologist here, they would probably say it goes way back to, you know, early human type of needs that are still kind of hardwired into us. Like we're looking not to be alone here on this planet, but to find some set of humans with whom we can be, simply be ourselves and not be threatened, not be afraid, but belong. My work as dean here, when I was dean of freshmen here, my joy was helping students. We had 1,700 in each class, as you know better than anybody. And, you know, I knew from my own life experience that there were plenty of students who might feel they had been admitted, but not really let in.
They were a mistake.
Yeah, or that maybe they didn't have quite what it took to be at the center of the place. And my job as dean of freshmen was to give a damn about that and to try to create a big enough embrace as the university to say, you are all not just admitted, but you are let in, you are in, you know, because I knew from the research around belonging that when a human feels someone gives a damn about them, one faculty member, one staff person, you know, it doesn't take many, they then feel they have a vested right to be there. And therefore, they will ask for help when they're floundering and they will go for the biggest, wildest dreams because they feel they have the right to. They belong.
And the flip side of that is the person who feels like they're an imposter.
Yeah.
They shouldn't be here.
Yeah.
Have you felt like an imposter in your life?
Absolutely. When we are members of groups about which negative stereotypes are held, we are painfully aware of those stereotypes, trying desperately not to be that stereotype often. And when we get some inkling, some evidence that that stereotype might be true, like we get a C. You know, when we are of a member of a group that's supposed to get C's, according to the big dominant narrative, then we start to believe the stereotype, like, oh my gosh, I'm only capable of a C, you know? And I definitely contended with that as an undergraduate. My first quarter here, I got a 2.0. And with help from the Academic Advising Center, which ironically I would go on to manage as dean of freshmen, you know, two decades later, they told me, no, you have what it takes, kid. Your intellectual aptitude is high, but your time management needs a lot of work, kid. You know, but I didn't know it was the time management. When I got those bad grades fall quarter, I thought, oh my gosh, I'm that black person. They
admit it. Defaulted to that.
I defaulted to the stereotype.
Narrative.
Yes.
Interesting.
And was ashamed and couldn't ask for help.
So the memoir is entitled Real American. What does it mean to be an American in your view?
I'm trying to reclaim this term for any of us who in the present discourse is presumed not to be a real American. You know what I mean? Sarah Palin used to stand up and say this when she was running for vice president with John McCain. Real Americans deserve this, that, and the other. Real Americans deserve this or want that or act this way. And I knew she wasn't talking about a good number of us, whether we are of color or we are children of immigrants or, you know, whatever. I'm tired of that term being used to draw lines between us as Americans. I'm trying to reclaim this term for all of us.
So what does it mean when you use this clause, 1,000 cuts of racism? What does that mean?
You know, these days, there's a lot of rhetoric around don't play the victim card, don't play the race card, as if this is all a big game. There's this critique from some in the majority who say, you know, get over it. It wasn't that bad. It didn't happen the way you say it did. Give them the benefit of the doubt. They're referring to things we call microaggressions or the 1,000 cuts of racism, the tiny little things that are done day in and day out in the schools, K through 12, in the college environment, in the workplace, in media, the various slights, the cuts that are made that are often so unexamined in the mind of the person saying them, they don't even realize what they're saying or what they're doing. But when we are the recipient of those things, the language, the touching of the hair, the, oh my gosh, somehow you're so incredibly articulate. I had that said to me in this room on this campus, you know, somehow, Julie, you're so articulate. What the fuck does that mean? You don't expect a black person to be able to talk like this. So you compliment me. It's an insult. You're insulting yourself, by the way, too. When these things happen over time, they become this cut and that cut and this cut and that cut, and you start to bleed, you know? And unless you have a really strong sense of self and you're in community with people with whom you feel belonging, that bleeding can turn into a hemorrhage, and pretty soon your entire sense of self is drained out of you.
So on campus today, we talk about microaggressions quite a bit, and we talk about the difference between intent and impact, right? And so what you're saying is that this person may not have the intent of being racist, but the fact is that the impact on the person receiving the comment feels very racist.
Absolutely. And, you know, the legal doctrine has kind of followed this path. It for a while back in civil rights legal doctrine, it was all about, well, you know, was there a discriminatory intent? Well, if not, we can't do anything about it. And then we evolved to, no, it didn't, you know, it isn't only about intent. If there's impact, if there's discriminatory impact, the law has to do something about that. You know, these were the things I studied as an undergraduate here. To the point of what's happening on college campuses today, we can no longer say, I didn't intend that. People who are saying things that are sort of emanating from this baked-in sense of whiteness is better, white people are legitimate, white points of view are the smarter points of view, and all of that, folks have to interrogate those assumptions. They don't realize they're making an assumption that's based on whiteness being better, being more correct, and so on. And it is time in this America, in the 21st century, for us to really unlearn those things and stop valuing people on the basis of their ancestry or skin color, and unpack the assumptions and biases that are baked into so many institutions and so many structures, so many conversations.
This is Stanford Pathfinders, more with best-selling author Julie Lithcott-Hames coming up. This is Stanford Pathfinders on Sirius XM Insight 121. I'm Howard Wolf, and I'm speaking with best-selling author Julie Lithcott-Hames. So in your book, there's a tremendous amount of discussion of your hair.
Yes.
And I've
How's it looking today, Howard?
It looks beautiful.
Oh, good. Thank you.
And I've read a lot about this topic over the years, but I think you do this masterful job of walking through the way that you've navigated your hair over the course of your life as a child, as a teenager, as a college student, and then now. And you mentioned just moments ago that one of the microaggressions that's most often perpetrated on black women is this discussion of hair. So could you walk us through that and tell us about the importance of hair in the black female psyche?
Yeah. So I want to unpack a lot of things here. you just said, can you walk us through that? Which I will, and I appreciate. And it's a lovely example of the presumption you and I are making, or maybe you are making, that the listeners right now don't understand what I'm talking about.
I suspect a lot of them do, but I suspect some of them don't.
No, exactly. So let's acknowledge that, though. There are people, there are Black people listening, we hope. There are people of color listening. So they're nodding. They're nodding.
They
don't need it explained to them. Yes. They don't need a walkthrough. And I want them to hear me say that.
Okay.
And I want the white folks to hear me say that, too. And I want to also acknowledge to those of you who are paying attention that when I said, Howard, how does my hair look? And he said, it looks great. What was I appealing to there? Not just my friend Howard and not just making a joke on radio, but the white male gaze is often the gaze that matters most in this nation, right? So it's like, do the white men approve of me? How do I look in their eyes? And I, as a Black woman, have had to contend with, do I have hair that is attractive to the people I'm trying to attract and please and approve? And of course, I don't want it to be about the male gaze, the white male gaze, any gaze. I want to look in the mirror myself and see a Black woman that I love, whose hair I like, and to have that be enough. And that gets back to these themes of belonging and self that we've been talking about. But now let me get to your question. Hair is a motif in this book. Hair for us as Black women is, as I say, the bane of our existence, either our pride or the bane of our existence, depending on things like the weather and the beauty products available in our town and other people's judgment. And so I was a Black woman, a biracial Black woman, who straightened her hair throughout her childhood with a curling iron or a hot comb to try to make it do what my white friend's hair did, which was flip like Farrah Fawcett. You know, I wanted that hair. All my friends had that
hair.
I wanted feathers. I promise you, my hair will not feather. And the minute I stepped outside, the humidity got to it, and they didn't even have products then for hair like mine. So I had a tumbleweed head, just frizz, and you couldn't tame it. It couldn't do anything. It was ugly. My white male friends in high school who had crushes on teased me for looking like Bozo the Clown. That was their favorite thing to say to me about my hair. And as I grew to love myself over the years, I was able to say, why am I pressing my hair to look the way other people might prefer it to look? Or when I go to the Stanford Shopping Center, it's better if I have my hair straightened and pulled back. You know, they don't want to see a, you know, wild-headed Black woman because they're afraid that person's here to steal from them. I contended with that constantly, those impressions being followed in stores, the sneers, the glances, and so on, right here down the street in Palo Alto. So I grew old enough to say, fuck that. You know, this is my hair. This is the hair God gave me, if you will. And I am going to love the heck out of it, and I'm going to wear it the way it wants to be worn. And nowadays, I delight in going out into the world with it in a more unkempt style because I am no longer at 50 interested in being kempt. You know, I'm interested in being me. This is the hair I have. I love myself. This is what it does. Take it or leave it. So the journey, if you pay attention to the book, at my hair, my psychological wellness evolves as my hair goes from pressed straight to naturally curly.
I want to talk about race in America today, because at the end of your book, that's where we end up. And we talk about what's happened in this country over the past 5 years. And I want to ask you the simplest question in the world to ask, but the most difficult question to answer, and that is very simple. Where do we go from here? It's 2018, and we still can't talk about race in America.
I think white folks have a lot of work to do to examine the assumptions and presumptions that are at the base and are the basis for white society, for American society. This isn't a country the rest of us want to be let into. We all want to matter here. We all want to make our way. We all want to find work and find love and not be judged or shot down because we have what in some people's eyes is the wrong skin color. There is a problem of whiteness in society. It is the basis for our taking land away from Native Americans, calling them savages along the way. As they were defending their land, we decide to call them savages and use that further against them. We'd steal their land. We enslave a set of people from Africa to work our land and create the biggest, best, most successful economy on the planet. The vestiges of those truths are with us still today in our institutions, in our systems, systems, from housing to banking. You look at the income inequality gap and you ask yourself why that is. And you don't have to go back hundreds of years. You go back to the GI Bill, when Black GIs were not given the same opportunities as white GIs to get home loans, to have the mortgage, to have the house, to then die and pass on to their children. Okay, that's one tiny example. The racism embedded in home loans and redlining racist realtors, you know, is a huge reason as to why we have such disparities in wealth between Blacks and whites today, for example. Those things need to be unpacked, understood, and addressed, and it starts at the individual level. Do I know Black people? Do I like Black people? Do I have Black people as friends? Am I interested in the Black experience and the Black narrative? And if I'm not, what can I do about it? Read books, watch TV shows, listen to podcasts, watch movies, learn, take an interest in a narrative that is not the dominant white American narrative, and your eyes and ears will open, and maybe your heart too. And then you can start to see us as the equals we're trying to be, and then we can make policies that lead to progress.
The hope was that when Barack Obama got elected president of the United States, not once but twice, that after that election and those two terms, that we would live in a post-racial America. Obviously, your feeling is very strongly that we're not even close to a post-racial America. But in many ways, it's even worse today. Would you agree with that?
Yes. Well, worse today, or just are we more clear on where the problems are? And I think it's many of us were not surprised by what happened in the wake of Barack Obama announcing his candidacy and becoming president. The wake meaning the hatred and all of that. Gun sales soared when folks found out Barack Obama was president of the United States. Do you think that's a coincidence? No. There were more hits on white supremacist websites. This is all monitored by the Southern Poverty Law Center the day after Barack Obama was inaugurated, either as his inauguration or his, you know, winning the election. Okay, like the hate came out when we got a Black president. Now, many of us who supported Obama thought, yes, oh my gosh, look, this is evidence. This is like the culmination of the civil rights movement. A Black man can be president of the United States. And a whole lot of other people were like, oh, hell no. We are not letting a man with Black or brown skin be the president of this country. And they disrespected him in office. That, I think, was a representative from South Carolina, that or senator, pretty sure representative, who shouted at him during the State of the Union, you lie. That had never happened before. That is what they began to do. So we have unearthed the racism that never went away. Why did it never go away? Because we've never told the truth of America's founding and what America is. We argue over monuments instead of saying, you know, the Confederacy was an attempt to secede and did secede from this nation. They lost. No other country has monuments to the people that tried to take it down. But us, like, come on, America. We have to reckon with that stuff. It's an ugly part of our background and our truth. And until we have those tough conversations, you know, we will still be having just the surface level conversations about, oh, that's unfortunate, or gee, it's too bad that happens. We're better than this. As humans, as Americans, we are better than this. We all just want a chance to be here and fall in love and get work and die in peace. Let's make it happen.
I can't think of a better way to end than that. Julie, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thanks, Howard, for having me. You're a dear friend. I love you. Thank you.
Right back at you.
Thanks.
Thanks for joining us on Stanford Pathfinders on Sirius XM Insight 121. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime, on demand, with the Sirius XM app.